pals o' mine. I was asked why I don't say my name at the beginning of the show. I don't know. So, I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. Every 4th of July, my father's side of the family has a reunion. My father's parents were each Scandinavian, so one of my older cousins always baked a type of Swedish bread for the picnic. Due to physical ailments, she hasn't been able to attend the picnics in the last couple of years, so I'm going to see if anyone in the family can continue the tradition. No, it can't be me. I'm a horrible cook, truly. But it's fun to enjoy at least a small tradition from the old country. When asked about my cultural heritage, I say I'm Scandinavian on my father's side. Scandinavia, of course, collectively refers to a few different countries. Imagine if your response was Native American. There are a plethora of tribes throughout the country, and erroneous assumptions and associations could be made with a tribe different than yours, which has completely different customs and traditions. Al Stripling's Native American ancestry is from a California coastal tribe. His deep involvement in the Native American culture, including working with the California State Indian Museum, offers a unique and informed perspective about this often misunderstood culture.
So my brothers and I, when we were kids, we were told that the family was Swedish. So when you hear Swedish, you naturally assume the family's from Sweden. When in reality, we learned as adults that they were actually from a Swedish village in Finland. Because poor Finland, Sweden ran the country for a while, and then Russia came in, and then Sweden came back again. So it was predominantly Swedish-speaking for half of the country. When my family emigrated in the late 1800s, my great-grandparents told the kids, first child was born in Finland, but not the rest of them, but they were very emphatic that we will not speak Swedish here. We're in America now. And as a result, my grandfather only had a smattering of words and phrases that he was familiar with. And as I got older, I thought that was kind of sad. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there was a few words, like I remember he used to call me flicka, which means girl. Mm-hmm. But that was it. And there was like a little Bible that's in Swedish. So my heritage doesn't have as much of the intensity of some ancestry that have, like, say, war-torn backgrounds, especially in Europe, of course, and Africa. But there's a sad pattern right now where a lot of heritage is being lost. And I think that, like my great-grandparents, their original intention of wanting their family to integrate in the new country is commendable. But sadly, a lot of the heritage and tradition is getting lost. And you have people in this generation not quite knowing who they are and trying to figure out where they are. And that's why these TV shows that are tracking genealogy have become so popular. But what's even sadder than that, on a deeper level, is that there are family members that you can actually talk to and get the stories, and that's not being done. The Native Americans, which I understand some don't care for that phrase because it lumps everybody in Eskimos and everybody. You know, yeah. You should know our tribes, but unfortunately for us that are not Native American, there are too many tribes and we don't know unless you tell us which one.
Right, that's much part of the mix. Right? Yeah. What do you call us? What do we call ourselves?
Mm-hmm. So tell me about your tribal ancestry.
It was, first of all, that I was Aztec from my mom's side of the family. She came across the river into Texas and was born, actually. Her family came across the river into Texas. She was born in El Paso and moved west to Bakersfield. The men were looking for work. And my father was born in Hollister. He always knew he had Native background, but of course, we just called ourselves Indian, or his family called themselves Indian, and still do to this day. So I didn't appreciate the meld or complexity of my family background until I became almost college age, a little bit in high school. And I thought it was cool to be Indian and Aztec background and so on. But I didn't know much of that until my later years. And then when my parents were getting older and became ill, my dad in particular, it dawned on me, I better look into this if I want to know anything at all, and also to provide some information to my father, because he knew he was Indian, but not what tribe, didn't know anything about the language, the culture, or anything.
So he didn't know either.
He was placed in an orphanage
as
an infant, both he and his sister. and of all places, up in Portland, Oregon. Moving down, actually riding the railroad tracks, trains, with his adoptive parents, his father, looking for field work, wound up in the southern San Joaquin Valley. And that's where he and my mother met. And so I was really raised in my mom's family till the age of 21, which was a Mexican Spanish-speaking family. And in later years, when I started investigating my father's background, I learned that we were from the Mission area, and that helped me put two and two together. Many of the Mission Indians, so to speak, spoke Spanish too, as a result of the Franciscan missions and the establishment of the missions all the way up from the Mexican border to Sonoma. And as I began searching my father's background, I began becoming really fascinated with Native culture in general. I started learning all the terminologies and the words, and basically got real mixed up. I didn't know what to call us, like we were just talking about. Some people referred to it as Indian, Mission Indian. And then I happened to go to school up at Humboldt State in Humboldt County. And there were Indian people there who knew their tribal background, knew where they were from, and knew many generations, knew the cultural ceremonies and all of those kinds of things. And I knew none of that. I knew some of my Mexican family background. So that was my first introduction to being Indian, Native country, and being aware that there are lots and lots of Native populations in California. And I didn't know exactly what mine were. And so I eventually started looking into the Mission area. The help of my oldest sons, my oldest son, and I have two boys, we started finding out some nitty-gritty information. We found out we're from the AMA group, AMA, in the Hollister area, where the two rivers flow into Monterey Bay, and found out some very good specifics that became even more fascinating. But I was never drawn into that area because of the people I met and the work I was involved with, which was with the state university system. And through those involvements, met many students, many of whom were Native students, and I was offered a job or to apply for a job in a multicultural program, lots of diversity, met more Indian students, and eventually wound up being a sponsor of the Native American Student Club. So that's when my education really began.
So what would a Native American club, a university, do? What would your average activity entail?
First of all, struggle to stay in school.
Oh, okay.
That was always a struggle. It seemed no matter what campus we looked at, we're always 1% enrollment. So if it's 100,000 students or 8,000 students, we'd be about 1% of that population. In terms of organization, varied all over the place. From very organized, which meant you had one or two students who were really into organizing that were part of the club, or very disorganized and really didn't accomplish much on campus. Basically, it was an attempt to hang together, be with people that they could identify with, and then perhaps put together some cultural programs. And the knowledge of cultural programs varied from A to Z, too. Some people were very steeped in their culture, came from reservations, knew reservation life, some in California, some outside. And others were embarrassed because they knew they were Indian but didn't know a thing about it. And that was kind of where I came from too. I didn't know a thing about Native culture. I didn't know. I've heard of people who had songs, and I heard about Sweat Lodge, and I heard about the Plains people primarily because of the movies and the literature that was out, but very little about California Indians.
Now, what time period are we talking?
Probably in the late 60s, in terms of when I started getting involved in exploring culture and meeting people. And from 1966 through 2003, thereabouts, I progressed from knowing virtually nothing to being a docent at the State Indian Museum because of my fascination with the culture and my growing realization that this is really important. None of my parents, either on the Aztec Mexican side or Native cultural side, knew anything about our real history, indigenous history. And by indigenous, I mean all people from Western Hemisphere who were from the land, in Mexico, Central America, all those places, there were indigenous people there, but there were also colonized people, just like the United States and Canada have. So I started learning about all the things that were part of our culture. And some were very superficial, you know, the names and terminologies and some of the so-called cultural activities that were really later kinds of things during reservation and removal times when the federal government removed people from their homelands, set up various kinds of reservations, Indian schools where people, basically children, were taken away from their families to try to get the culture erased from their knowledge base. So all those kinds of things were coming to the surface for me, and I started realizing and going through the emotional ups and downs of learning the culture and knowing this is a part of me that I've never known about, and having some compassion too for my father for the first time in a real different way. I always knew him as a worker. He was a really hard worker, and both of my parents were. But seeing that what he didn't know about his culture and what there was to be proud of in that, and having been in an orphanage, he didn't know anything of that and was raised in a Catholic orphanage and was adopted by an African-American family, whose name I still carry, and knowing nothing about that side of the family either.
Well, this is what I was curious about when you mentioned the time frame, the 60s, because we're talking about Black movement, the Chicano movement, the women's movement, were all kind of intermingled there. And I wondered if that was an influence, had an impact on you as well with your heritage. And
because I worked in the university system, political awareness and social awareness, all that consciousness raising, all the activities that went on, did inspire me to be involved. But I learned that the Native American involvement was different, because all the other so-called minority groups, as they were called, ethnic groups, all different kinds. And we weren't even talking about gay rights or other kinds of disability rights and things like that. All the different aspects of disenfranchised peoples, Native Americans had a different, I guess, view as to what we needed. We were on our homeland, basically. We were in our own country, but we were being clumped together. So within the so-called Native American conglomerate, as the United States tried to make us appear to be, we were many different nations. And so we had different causes, different needs, different awarenesses of what our needs were. We were not one big total group with a common experience. African Americans had certain experiences and banded together around that. A lot of the Hispanic people or Mexican American people had similar kinds of issues, the women's rights issues and so on. But in California, for example, if we have 100 or more different tribal groups, we didn't even use the word tribes way back. You know, there were groups and clans and families and so on. But it was very difficult to even pull together an alliance to fight off the missions, for example, until way later on. And even then, it wasn't a powerful alliance. A war, in a way, was kind of a foreign thing until we pushed up against the wall. Then you defend yourself or try to remove people who are instigating impoverishing kind of activities and enslavement kinds of activities. So we were still dealing with our own smaller groups and with the whole idea of national awareness among ourselves until later in the 50s and 60s and even 70s, when national movements of Native Americans came about. Longest Walks, the American Indian Movement, or AIM as people call it, where people started standing up politically and forcefully, bringing awareness to the government. For example, the Longest Walk went across the country to Washington, D.C., and people accumulated, you might say, as they went across the country, and awareness arose as they did that. So our issues were just basically like here on our homeland, and also everybody else here who is looking for their own personal rights are also on our homeland. So we're looking to what are, in fact, are our issues. What are they? And we didn't necessarily like the idea of preservation. And a lot of the things that scientists came in and tried to do once they realized that we were so-called, in quotes, the vanishing race. We didn't care for that either.
So what do you mean? What did the scientists
do? The anthropologists, archaeologists, who came in and tried to preserve things because they're disappearing. And then museums arose. They're kind of like on the curio cabinet kinds of mentalities, like in Europe. Explorers went out and brought things back that were fascinating and of interest, and they'd have parties, and people would come in and see these odd things. We don't want to fit into that. And to this day, there are still, among Native communities, disagreements about the existence and roles of museums that supposedly represent our cultures. And some of them are really good, but it's hard to interpret anybody's culture by so-called artifacts or even a better name, cultural materials, dance regalia, spiritual items that are used for ceremonies. It's hard to interpret any culture by those kinds of material items. Native American identity, and I'm aware I'm switching from Indian, Native American, or Native, all those kinds of terms.
Well, I was going to ask you, do you have one, any preference?
Myself and among most Native communities who have serious discussions about identities, we all have our own names. Our group is called Ama.
Right.
And that word means both person and it means true. And that's basically similar across the country. If you find any Native group's indigenous name for themselves, it typically means true person, true human, or something of that nature.
Hmm. I don't know if this is true or not, but the word Indian means one people. Is that true?
No, I don't think so. That was just Columbus's mistaken labeling, thinking he was going to the Indies.
No, I meant the breakdown of Latin. Like it breaks down the parts of the word. Like you break down the parts of the word. Like,
oh.
You know, like uni, it means one.
Okay, familiar with that.
Okay.
But here, that is a good question, though, because having a role as a docent at the Indian Museum, here at the State Indian Museum, our staff and myself often get asked, is it okay to say the word Indian? Isn't that derogatory? Because on the East Coast, I understand you really don't do that. You talk about Native Americans or something of that nature, or the tribal names. And Canada, the First Nations, and in other parts of the country, there are different kinds of preferences like that. And so basically, that's like preferential kind of things in terms of political names.
I like First Nations, because you weren't here first, so that makes perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
As I said earlier, there are so many different tribes.
Right.
And so you can't just say, you can't blanket a demographic.
Right.
With just one tribe. That's
what seems to have happened, and this is not any kind of an educated interpretation of it, but what seems to have happened in California, people here decided little by little over time that we own that word now, Indian. So that's ours, so we use it as we please.
So here it's okay.
Here it seems to be okay. And that's, even if you go to some of the very rural areas or mountain areas, or go to powwows, you see stickers and decals and pickup sunscreens that say redskin, or skins, or native, or something of that sort. And they use it frequently, and shouldn't say they, we use that in-house, you know, liberally. In fact, some of the powwow t-shirts will have the big initials N-D-N. Because we often pronounce it Indian.
Oh, okay.
So we kind of play with that word. It's our word. It's our thing. And just like many of the other ethnic groups, they use words too in their communities.
And that they can use, but you
somebody
can't.
Somebody else better not
yes.
use them. So we do the same things. The same kind of socialization and reemergence is taking place. And I think there is a national recognition of us as a people now, but still with our very distinct national identities. And by national, I guess you could equate that to tribal identities. People refer to the being Lakota or Ojibwe or Mohawk or Ama, as in my case.
I wasn't familiar with Ama.
On the maps, you will normally see Ohlone.
Okay.
Or in the older term, applied by the Spanish, the Costanoan. But the Costanoan refers to us being coastal people.
Okay.
And the Ohlone was really a misinterpretation or misspelling of a village name that was on the western coast of the San Francisco Peninsula. Because from the peninsula of San Francisco and East Bay all the way down to Monterey Bay, and on the east side, roughly bordered by the Coast Range over to about Interstate 5, that's basically all of the Costanoan Ohlone area. And within that, there are 8 distinct groups and 8 distinct dialects. Ours is called the Mutsun, M-U-T-S-U-N. Very few people really speak that fluently, if anybody at all. Our last fluent speaker, I think, crossed over or passed on about 1931 or 32, thereabouts. I've forgotten the exact date.
Well, that's another concern. Even though you referenced, you know, curios in museums, language is a very strong history that unfortunately is word of mouth and not preserved or recorded. I know attempts have been made over the decades to, even in the hills, non-indigenous people, mm-hmm. the Ozarks, they've been trying to capture and sure. record. So as far as your tribe, your people, how are you doing with them?
There was good fortune in that J.P. Harrington did extensive research in our area, in particular with the last fluent speaker we had and her family, and took copious notes. And he was a linguist as well, but he had very specialized kinds of ways that he described in symbol form, like linguists do, what our language was like. He has lots of notes, and I believe there is somebody at UC Davis who is actually compiling a dictionary.
Nice.
So there, we're one of the languages in the state that is most documented, and there are some classes going on. I've only attended one, but I have some notes and a portion of a dictionary, language lists, word lists, and so on that we're trying to learn from some of the families, especially who still live in the area. Santa Cruz, roughly, Hollister, Watsonville, are trying to teach their children from those pages, literature, and not literature, but words, word lists, meanings, and so on, coloring books, children's stories, and things like that.
Of course, you need to actually use it, or it will be forgotten. So what would you suggest for families? Actually, you have all those visitors come into the museum. You know, it'd be great if you could have handouts that gave suggestions of exercises or families that could do it, even if they're not indigenous. I think it'd be nice to carry that information, the education on through their adulthood so they can pass it on to their children.
The way we address the so-called mission to educate the public that the State Indian Museum has is by compiling a really, really extensive list of books as current as possible. The coordinator for all the educational programs and other events similar to that makes a point of, first of all, purchasing up-to-date books. Some of them aren't even out yet before they're trying to purchase them. And every year in November, we have authors of those newest books, if they're willing to come, sign off their books to people who want to buy them and do a half-hour presentation. So that's one attempt to just get the education out there about California tribes in general. We don't put a great effort on the languages because the tribal groups are doing that themselves in their locations.
I was wondering if there are any podcasts or something or blog talk radio that maybe some tribes have out there that people could listen to and hear some of the phraseology.
I believe some do. Some of them are very localized, like just the reservation, because it's for their people.
Right.
So it's not broadcast any further than that,
okay.
As far as I'm aware. There's a great program or effort, I should say, at Yocharihi up near Woodland. They're doing great things with their casino monies and other tribal funds. They do have up-to-date technology, and the kids have the iPods to take home. It has their language on it. They learn their songs on it. They learn cultural things as well as current things in their language, because our languages are generally very really old, so they don't have words for television and
that's true
and computers and things
or
like
iPods
that. Or iPods, and so words have to actually be invented.
Well, speaking of casinos, I was told a couple years ago that it's a problem with high school kids that are not completing high school because their perspective is, well, why bother? I'm just going to get a job at the casino. Obviously, it's not all the casinos or all the different demographics, but it is an ongoing, there's a pattern that has been set now. It's like kids that get into drugs, like, why go to school? I'm just going in the mm-hmm. corner and do this or that.
Sure.
So apparently there's been a drop in graduates, which is troubling. And I'm just wondering if there's anything in particular that could be done about that.
First of all, I think it's probably misleading to say that because they'll get a job at a casino. Because dropouts from schools from fourth grade up has always been high. It's been a problem forever and ever since public schools started. In my efforts through the university, working with the Educational Opportunity Program, in particular with my own personal emphasis whether it was with Native American communities. It's very, very common. If I go out and to a site to recruit students, Native American students, in some cases, instead of going to the regular high school, I'd have to go to the continuation school because that's where most of the Native students were, or an alternative school or something of that nature. And that was way before casinos were even here. Many of the kids would get relegated to vocational programs, or they can't cut the college prep programs or whatever it is, but there wasn't an effort to provide counseling staff or teaching staff or whatever that were sensitive or knowledgeable about the issues that were involved. And I'm very appreciative of teachers in general, because that's what I did for a long time when I got out of school, 7th through 12th grade, before I got into the university system. And so I saw that firsthand happening. I taught in Lake County for a while, and the Pomo students there, at least in the early years, late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s, it was hard to find programs that were geared towards students that were encouraging them to go to college. That was brand new. The program I worked for, typically called EOP, started in the late 60s. And that was very small to begin with, and later state funded. And it was geared towards specifically those people who were underrepresented in the college systems. And then it took many years for that program to really get going and even to understand what the needs were of those students as the university kept changing as well. So we had to provide support services, incentives, and also educate the students about what college was really all about. And even to this day, there's still a huge emphasis on getting a certain major to have a certain career. And that's where you get into conflict too, when with many Native communities, because that doesn't seem to bring about well-rounded human being, going back to the name of true person, true human. There are lessons the culture teaches that are not in line with the university's goals and objectives and their missions. We still have a sign up on the freeway here kind of telling what the university thinks students are, you know, somebody who's made at the university, as opposed to somebody who's fulfilling their own evolvement and their own interest, or giving back to their own family, their community, things like that. It's kind of like out external to family. And for many of the indigenous cultures, that's taking away from family instead of bringing things back, and especially to culture in general. So it's a difficult thing to balance, because universities, colleges, schools, high schools, elementary schools have good intentions, but the intentions are different than our community's intentions. So to educate a person and the parents who are sending students off to a public school, whether it be elementary level, high school, or college, is a very complex chemistry. To say that we're going to honor your culture and your family, but at the same time have them be a business major or science major or something like that. I think that's changing now. And when I've presented at Native American education conferences, I've talked about using the principles of our own culture to develop a curriculum around, as opposed to the standard curriculum principles, because that's from a different culture altogether. Ours encompasses those ideals that are in a democratic society. We encompass that. It's always been in our culture. And so our philosophies and our education can be built around ours very efficiently.
Now, I understand that at some point there were college scholarships or percentage paid for if you were within a certain generation of descendants of tribes. Is that still on the table?
There's some of that. There was the prominent one, aside from individual scholarships, which can vary across the board, was the Bureau of Indian Affairs Higher Education Grant. But typically, a person had to be from a recognized tribe. And so to prove that, very difficult in some cases. Many of the students in California have difficulty identifying what tribe they're from in terms of federal recognition. So we know personally, or like myself, I can tell you what my tribal background is, but I'm not federally recognized. So I didn't get to apply, and neither did my two boys get to apply for higher education grants. There are other things available outside of the Native-focused financial assistance, but those are more narrow when you talk about federal assistance through the Bureau of Indian Affairs or reservation-specific awards, things like that. And working in the community, the CSU system for quite a while, I met many students we're funded by the tribal people, but you can't say by many students. I mean, there might be two from a particular tribe in the Oklahoma area that come to this particular school where I'm working, or from the Hoopa Reservation up north or the Yurok. There's one from here, two from there, one from there. So myself meeting 20 or 30 students is a small number over the many years that I worked. I was at more than 32 years in the CSU system.
So it's ironic to me that it's kind of come full circle that even though those not only offensive to the tribes, but just poorly made movies, generally they were offensive, mm-hmm. they're so bad, but obviously it planted a seed in subsequent generations' perspectives. But I say it's ironic come full circle in that the culture of the Native American tribes are now of interest to people pursuing spirituality and trying to find a connection with themselves in the universe, such as the music and sweat lodges, as you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. retreats, vision quests.
Sure.
What have you noticed recently that seems to be coming up more in some of your conversations with those trying to seek assistance, spiritual assistance?
Well, as a docent with the State Museum, I've had quite an opportunity to meet people from all over the world, because that little building, 26 and J, I always call it that, or 26 and K Street, it's such a small little facility, but it's such a magnet. At the same time, I've met people literally from many, many, many countries from all over the world. There, and many of them are interested in Native American spirituality. And we invariably get into that when we talk about the ceremonial dances that are held there, or the nature of thinking that goes into basket making, or what the adolescent ceremonies entail for a young Native girls or boys when they become a new a young adult. All those kinds of things bring up questions. Well, what are they taught? What do they believe? Is that still being passed on? And they want to know about the relationship with nature and the world. What's the world view like, and so on. It's driven me, first of all, to think about all of that. You know, do I understand it sufficiently to explain it to people? Truthfully, I have my own picture of it now because of my many years of doing that kind of work and research and reading. And what I found out is that over the years that I read and learned and was involved in Native community, including traditional powwow style dance, making regalia, making some of the implements like pump drills, various items for the museum, doing arrow points or spear points out of obsidian, all of those kinds of things have led me into understanding why you have to have a certain mindset, a certain belief system before you participate. Those kinds of things. And I've been really, really fortunate to meet elders in the community. As I mentioned earlier, I was never drawn into the Amamutsun culture. I've met people there and I know people to this day there, but I was drawn up to areas like Mount Shasta, the tribal communities in those areas who still hold the ceremonies and tribal grounds in continuity. And people outside of that area, Rolling Thunder over in Carlin, Nevada, Cherokee Medicine Man, and others like him from the Pitt River and up in that general area in northeastern California. As I learned how to be Indian, quote unquote, I learned to also be careful. Because at first, just like an enthusiast, I guess when you get into a culture that you really didn't know much about, if anything, I got excited about it. And I got angry about the history of things, how things happened. But then I sort of evened things out along the way as I began to understand myself as a human being. And so tying all that together with people coming into the museum and asking questions about spirituality and being involved with people face-to-face through the ceremonies, learned to put my hands on leather and stone and feathers and things like that, learn what they're for, how they're gifted to a person, has really taught me to be careful and respectful about what I say about my things as well as what belongs to another culture. And as a docent in the museum, I have to be very mindful. I'm from Amamutsun culture, but also intertribal culture, because I've learned from various different tribal elders, including shaman. And so I learned that I can't pretend to talk about the Yurok, the Hoopa, the Pomos, and the Apaches, even other people in the Mutsun area, the Ohlone people, the Okuts, because I'm not them, and I can't just sing their songs. I can't try to learn their languages or things like that, because that's their precious spiritual identity. So what I've learned and to share with people is that there is a commonality. There is a central theme, and we don't have to learn each other's languages and spiritual ways. It's more important to learn the theme. And that's a whole new program in itself. But what I really learned to say to those questions is I share what I've learned, how I've learned it, how I was drawn into the culture, and where it's taken me and brought me to this point, which is that there is a common theme in terms of spiritual thinking, spiritual practice, and understanding why we do things like meditation and why that's similar to prayer, how it is. And you don't have to go to Sweat Lodge. You don't have to do the Sun Dance unless that really draws you individually, because that theme is already connected with you. And all you have to do is find out where that connection is. And so what I share with people helps them find that spot in them where that spiritual source is, then that's great. But it's them, and there is that common theme, and there is that common way to be as a human being. There is one human race.
Are there a few suggestions, resources that you find yourself giving frequently to people that cross your path?
Well, speaking from the museum standpoint, because of the questions people ask, we've taken the pains to select certain books for the museum that share stories from the elders. And we make the point of trying to get more literature from women in our communities, and a variety of literature. Some of it is kind of gets into the political, cultural kinds of things, the mission experiences, for example. But there are also some stories that are about individual personalities. You know, Black Elk is one who was very popular in the old days. There's Carlos Castaneda and Don Juan, the Yaqui medicine person, called him a sorcerer. And things like that, they give clues. But there isn't a Native American Bible.
Well, I would think not.
Or even a composition or a compilation of Native beliefs. There are some things like the book called The Sacred that gives you hints. But it takes a broad range of reading. I've read a lot of things because I've been inspired to by the literature that I've read, and also by the shaman and elders that I've met. They basically are able to tell me, and other people as well, whether you're on the right path or not. Your right path, not somebody else's, and not the right path, because it's different for everybody. From that exploration, I've found my literature, the literature that was meaningful to me. And that led me to read not only Native American literature, but also what the Sufis have to say, what the Buddhists have to say, what the Christ or Jesus literature has to say, all those kinds of things. And from my own personal experiences in Sweat Lodge or in the ceremonies up north, talking with elders, doing fast through the Native processes, I learned that there is the theme that's common to all of it. And if you look carefully enough, all those other books I just mentioned, the spiritual ways, say similar things. And I now can look at a new spiritual book of some sort for somebody else's, and I'll say, I wonder how they say it. And I'll look, and there it is, in somewhere in that book. So that's what I found, and so I share that story with people. So if you're looking for it, you'll find it, because of the fact you're looking.
Now, that was on behalf of the museum. What about on a personal counselor level?
I tell them basically the same kinds of things on a personal counseling level. We get into what people call more metaphysical and those kinds of things that at that point. But I don't like to use things that sound mystical. People call things esoteric or metaphysical and those kinds of things. And basically, I understand those to be what science can't prove, what people can't see, or what they don't think they can feel or figure out with their own logic, like prayer, for example. Or if you have a sense, you listen to your gut, which we typically mean is our heart. Listen to your own heart, you'll know. How many times have we been told that? Oh, just listen to your heart, you'll know. But what time should I do this? You'll know. You'll know. Trust yourself. Those are the esoteric metaphysical kind of things. And we already do that. That kind of thing. You get a hint that, oh, I should call my mom. I haven't called her in a while. And you call her and she says, oh, I was just thinking about you. That's metaphysical. And so I talk to people about how to, in a counseling way, how to listen to their natural processes. Those real subtle energy kind of things where that's already going on. We've just been conditioned to use our mental logic, to pay attention to science. If you can't prove it, doubt it. If you can't replicate it like scientists like to do, then it was probably a fluke. But those are the kind of things that animals do it. They can hear things we don't hear, or we think we don't hear. We just weren't paying attention to them.
Or we're taught as children to ignore.
Right. And so that's very easy to look at when you send a Native American child raised in a Native family that is trying their best to be so-called traditional. You send your child to public school and they come home at the end of the day and they tell you what their school day was like, what their teacher said and what they're learning. And then you have to go over that as a family and say, but remember, competition is not what it's all about. It's helping each other. But why can't I help somebody with their test if they don't know? That's against the public school rules.
Now, of course, there's the flute. The lovely, magical Native American flute is also very popular in the metaphysical community. It's very soothing. And now there are different types of wood that are used, just like any other instrument. Mm-hmm. There are different formats. And I understand that you teach.
Yes, it's typically called the Native American flute, I guess because of the style. What I've learned, because I consider myself still a beginner, I played just over a year, because of both the benefits I've gained from it, as well as the difficulties I've gone through with it, I realized that you just can't pick up the flute and make it sound Native American, quote unquote. So I was able to pick it up fairly well and fairly easily after a time, and with a lot of my own personal effort. I've never gone to a teacher, and so I thought, this is something that everybody is interested in, because when I take it with me to the museum and play, it always draws a little crowd. So we started selling the flute. And then I decided, well, if you're going to sell the flute, I'll teach a free lesson for anybody who buys one, because it helps a person get over the frustration of not knowing what to do at first, why something's gone wrong or doesn't sound right. And they're fairly easy to correct. That is the little trials and tribulations a beginner goes through. And how to make it sound Native American is really some fingering techniques. So it is a cedar flute typically, but it's made out of all different kinds of woods now. People have experimented widely, hardwoods and softwoods, but cedar seems to be one of the earlier kinds of flutes. And there are other ones locally. Native American people make them out of elderberry.
Hmm.
Elderberry wood, because it can be hollowed out fairly simply and holes drilled in it. A different style than the cedar flute, though. Typically a person will recognize a cedar flute, 1.5 feet, 2 feet long shaft hollowed out, and it's got a small hole in one side and a larger bore on the other side, and you blow into the smaller hole on one end, and there's some kind of a block or an effigy on the top, typically a bird of some sort, and that helps channel the air across the sound hole, and it has 5 or 6 holes where you place your fingers, and then you start.
And as a hiker, let me just say that you can just pop that in the back of your pack and you're good
yep.
to go.
Many people do that, yeah. And I think, too, it is a soothing, calming kind of instrument. The sound is very mellow, and it's fun to learn. The classes that I have there, it's like adults going to kindergarten.
I was thinking of the recorder that we had when we were kids,
right.
The plastic thing.
Right. If you can do one of those, and that's other people have played wind instruments sometime because their parents made them learn some kind of music. But if you can blow or whistle or make a tune on a harmonica or something like that, you're good to go.
Do you have any favorite quotations?
I'm not sure if they qualify as quotes. And there are a few things that some of the elders tell us and remind us. They have to do with people who try real hard to be good people and follow the so-called red road or the spiritual road, do the right things in life and so on. And one example, who was actually the drum keeper that I drummed with for a while and sweat leader, he actually went to school, college, and graduated with his bachelor's and his master's degree. And he went up to relax and kick back with some of the elders in Northern California, and he was sharing this at our next drum practice session. He said he went up there and talked with this old man, just relaxing, sitting out in the sun. And he said, "Boy, you know, after finishing all these years of school, sometimes I still wonder if I'm doing it right." And he looked at the old man and said, "Don't you wonder sometimes if you're doing life right?" And the elderly man turned and looked at him and said, "No, all we're here for is to help life. See, we're the ones who make it complicated."
I have to admit that sometimes when I was young, I envied the Indian's jet black hair. I have a book to share, Glow by Ned Bowman. The creative, descriptive writing is incredible. In fact, Jim Shepherd's review referred to the dexterity of its sentences. It's intelligent, sometimes intellectual. Writing, it's sophisticated and witty. Here are a few excerpts. "Like copper on rooftops, the tattoos on their forearms have discolored with age. In this case, black to dark blue. Eyes so big and liquid that in his irises you can see the same subtle rainbows that swim in the film of grease on a puddle. The Pomeranian's long tongue hangs out of its mouth like a cord to be pulled in an emergency. There is a wasp in the ashtray, almost dead, shivering in small circles like a mobile phone left to vibrate on a table." Pretty cool, huh? Again, that's Glow by Ned Bowman. That's BEAUMAN. Do something different. Hire a skilled senior for your business.